Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Square Ball Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is the Phil Hay Show, which is brought to you by West Yorkshire Electrical, fully powered by West Yorkshire Electrical. These are a fully accredited electrical company. They have services in renewables, solar panels, battery storage, EV chargers. You've got an electric car now, do you, Michael?
I do. I didn't install the charger myself. Apparently there are better qualified people doing it.
You didn't open up a lamppost and think there's some electric in there somewhere?
That's what Phil's game is, that, I think. but yeah, I mean, if you need to speak to anyone about electrical work, I'm available. If you want it to not set your house on fire, West Yorkshire Electrical.
Yes, probably go to the professionals. And they also have roofers now, right?
Again, something I can do, technically speaking. But yeah, if you want it to not leak all the time, okay, rather than just some of the time, like mine, yeah, I'd speak to them about that.
Please do, yeah. So that's West Yorkshire Electrical, sponsors of the Phil Hay Show. So with me today, Michael Normanton, and star of the show, Phil Hay. How are you, mate?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you. Yes, not bad at all.
Excellent, excellent. So let's start as we mean to go on. We've not spoken to you since the Hull game. Hull game, Elland Road, fans very nervous, quite frantic. It's that time of the season, I think. What was your view of that?
Not spoken to you since Watford either. And I would say that the Easter weekend was probably pretty much as we expected it to be. Difficult. I thought both games looked difficult on paper. I thought they were difficult in the flesh as well. We were saying before we came on air, weren't we? I think got away with it slightly, Leeds, although I did think in the end deserved to beat Hull. I think they had enough in the closing stages to merit the goal that came their way. But there were certainly periods at Vicarage Road where it felt as if that game was going to get away from them. And I think at Watford, it felt to me against Hull that it was just a bit more of, you know, mileage in the legs and the fact that you are into the running now and everybody is just desperately trying to, you know, find that last bit of energy that gets them over the line. I think at Watford, it was cumulative effect of what had gone on in the international breaks, the players that Farker had lost to injury, particularly Gruev. I would say, you know, Roberts out for 3 weeks isn't helpful, but Roberts is not really getting into the starting lineup. Excuse me. Nonto, again, you've got Dan James scoring a lot of goals, a lot of assists, Somerville who's playing every week. So it doesn't strengthen Farker's hand to be without them. But the difference with Gruev is that you take him out of the team and you're talking about a complete reshuffle. I don't think the team was right at Watford. I understood Farker's explanation that Firpo coming back late from international duty with the Dominican Republic meant that didn't feel he could start him, didn't think he could play him for a long stretch. But there was no doubt, I don't think, that once Firpo came on and there was the reshuffle that shifted Ampadu back into the back four, and that Leeds looked more dangerous and looked more organised. And, you know, the bottom line with it is that you were breaking up a really, really strong, dependable centre-back partnership, which I think has to stick together now for the rest of the season and the games that are left. And I don't think a coincidence that when it came to Hull on Monday night, okay, Firpo with a little bit more recovery time, but that you saw a back four that allowed Rodon and Ampadu to link up together, because that's been absolutely rock solid, particularly in open play.
Given your propensity to doom things, Phil.
Yes.
We're pre-press conference here, so which of Ampadu or Rodon will be injured?
Well, the big wait, he's due to speak in about an hour, Farker. The big question will be whether or not Gruev is fit. I mean, when you have Byram available and you have Firpo available, there is the option, as you know, was the case on Monday, to move Gray into the centre of midfield. And I think the feeling as time went on at Watford was that it might have been worth pushing Firpo from the start to allow you to have a back four that meant that Ampadu and Rodon stayed together rather than to shift it up with Cooper coming into the back four. I didn't feel that it was Cooper's fault entirely for the two goals, but clearly Watford's second in particular was a real mess. And he is coming to the end now, Cooper. I don't think there's been any expectation on his part at all that there's going to be a new contract at the end of this. And there just is no justification for shifting away from Ampadu and Rodon at the back. I think even if Struijk hadn't gone for surgery and wasn't out for the season, he'd be doing very well to shift Ampadu out of that left-sided slot.
All season it's been about the Late Late Show of Ipswich that carried on again on Monday, but we've had a little bit of the Late Late Show across Watford and Hull. Matteo Joseph coming on Friday night. Have you ever seen a sub score quicker than that 15 seconds?
I don't think I have. I was thinking about this and I must have seen a sub score with the first touch or something close to the first touch. And I know it was his second, but it was essentially, you know, the first chance he'd had to get anywhere near the ball. He's becoming a really big impact player off the bench. And I don't think it's going to take too much time before he starts to put himself strongly in contention to start as well. I think for the time being, the structure with Bamford up front is what's worked really well for Farke since January. And he shows no inclination to shift away from that or to move back towards a setup with Pirro in the team. And I'm sure we'll get onto the Somerville penalty, but that you know, that's all kind of interlinked. Pirro's lack of game time vis-a-vis the fact that he is still, you know, the kind of number one penalty taker. And you have this unusual situation where your chosen penalty taker is struggling to get minutes on the pitch. But I think Joseph is starting to look a little bit like Archie Gray. I mean, Archie Gray looks like the superior player of the two, but one of those academy players coming through who you think you're going to see a lot of as time goes on. I mean, the late goals have been key, but Ipswich do keep doing it. And I was having a look back, having a look through Opta's stats about how much they've been doing it this season. And their return from losing positions, they've picked up 31 points from losing positions, which is incredibly impressive and really high statistic. I mean, it is kind of part of a broader picture in football. We did a piece last week on our site, which was talking about the fact that in the Premier League, you've got more goals per game this season than any time since the 60s. You've got more comeback wins, likely to be more comeback wins in this season than there's ever been in the Premier League before. So I think the tone of that piece was basically, or the conclusion of it was, that it's never been less important to score the first goal. Even so, Ipswich, their ability to get out of tight corners is incredible. And I think the last thing I expected coming out of the Easter weekend was that it would be them who were top of the table.
Yeah, and it's just getting really annoying, isn't it, Michael? They keep on putting the ball in the back of the net.
They didn't really, I mean, I didn't watch the Southampton game either, but I was because I was busy selling the magazine, but I was kind of hearing it being watched in the, I guess, in the northeast corner. I'm kind of hearing it from people on the screens in there, and I'm following it on my phone, and I can see the stats, and there's a little momentum graph on FotMob, and I can see Southampton have got loads of the ball, they're having lots of chances. It just feels like every time Ipswich have a chance, they score it this year.
Somebody said on Twitter after the Blackburn game on Friday, and I thought this jumped out more than Southampton because I watched the Blackburn game. I didn't think Ipswich played at all well. I thought they were lucky to get out of that with 3 points. Somebody said on Twitter, fair play to Ipswich, because I have never seen them play well this season. Every time I've watched them, they've never performed to a level that's made you think, oh, they look like title winners. But you cannot argue with the points tally. You cannot argue with the number of games that they've won. And you can't pretend that it's luck to be top of the division in a season like this one. You remember right at the start of the season, Farker talked about what you need to finish top six, what you need to get promoted, what you might need to win the title. And he said, you know, 26 wins will pretty much get you up automatically because you will draw games. And amongst that, and the points will get you to a level where you can go up. Well, that leads on to 26 wins now, and it's still wide open, all to play for. They're still going to need a good return from the games that are left. And like you say, Ipswich sticking around, but I just wonder how bothered either of you two are now about the title specifically and whether it has really reached the stage where top two will do.
Specifically, I'm not at all bothered. Just go up.
I thought you might say that, yeah.
But, I mean, it would be nice. But you can't choose, can you? Not playoffs. I mean, that's what I want.
If it was title or nothing, sorry, if it was promotion or nothing, then of course promotion, but the title would be nice. We missed out on the celebration in the year with Bielsa, so that would be nice.
So I do think we didn't win the title when we went up from League One. And people still seem to have a good time, didn't they?
Yeah, definitely.
There weren't many people in Leeds that evening going, threw away that title, didn't we? From that early dominant position, I can't believe we've only got second.
No, this is it. This is it. And I think it'll be the same sort of feeling. And that'll definitely be in Farker's head as well. I'm sure he would love to have a third title on his record. But at this stage, and with it so tight, just getting yourself through the tape is kind of all that matters. I think the really big result on Monday was probably Leicester's more than anything, because you just had the sense of it starting to set in there. And I think there'd have been a huge amount of pressure on them if they hadn't turned that around and won that game against Norwich, who are in an awful lot of good form and have been for a while, and have Ipswich coming up this weekend, another key game. And I think that that genuinely is a game where you can see Ipswich dropping points. That's probably the hardest fixture that they've got left. But I would almost say the same about Leeds actually going to Coventry. I don't think there are many more difficult games for them ahead.
No, I don't think so. We'll come on to that in a second. You touched on the Somerville penalty incident. And I think actually all three of the goals against Hull had a certain amount of drama around them. Byram sticking it in with his molars, as we learned afterwards.
It was a good finish that, you know. Really good finish.
Had to hang in the air to get there.
Yeah. Even though it was about a yard out, it was could easily come off his arm, could easily put that over the bar, no problem. Good goal.
Oh, definitely. And a good time, even though we didn't kind of carry that momentum through. What was your view of the penalty incident then? We discussed it on the Match Ball afterwards, and all's well that ends well, ball hits the back of the net. But ultimately, the thing that I keep coming back to is, should that be happening at professional football?
No, I don't think so. It's a little bit complicated because it's not that you never see this, but it is, as I was saying earlier on, it's quite an unusual situation that your designated penalty taker, and I do think that is Perreault. It's always been a little bit ambiguous and a little bit of a movable feast. And Farke has spoken before about how he's kind of happy, whether it's Perreault or Somerville, you know, both good penalty takers. I would suggest that Perreault is probably the more dependable of the two, looking at the way he strikes the ball and the way he finishes. But I think they're both very, very good. But it doesn't feel as if it's kind of nailed down and that there's one decision, I think, comprehensively decided that it won't be Bamford now, which makes sense. In my reading of what Farkas said afterwards, and I should say that I wasn't at the game on Monday, we had Nancy covering it for us. But from what Farkas said, I think he was quite happy in the end that Somerville took it. He seemed to be saying that he felt that Perreault had been on the pitch for too short a period of time, wasn't necessarily warmed up enough, a bit cold, a little bit like you saw with England in the Euros. And it suited him that Somerville went for the ball instead. I think what was particularly odd was that the decision wasn't made before Perreault had put the ball down and was basically about to strike it. And that does seem like a risky point at which to intervene, and not only Somerville to intervene, for them then to have words and other people to come and get involved. Like you say, it doesn't matter in the grand scheme if Somerville scores. But if he hadn't scored that and if it had finished 1-1, there'd have been an awful lot of conversation about that, and rightly so. And it's not the first time at Leeds, I have to say, where you feel as if the whole penalty thing isn't quite under control or as clear as it needs to be. And I don't think Farke would want to see that over and over again. The complication here is that Perreault is essentially first choice penalty taker, but Perreault can't get a game. You know, he's not getting many minutes at the moment. And even on Monday night, you know, when the change had to come, first change, it was Joseph who came on, you know, up front. It was Joseph who came on for Bamford rather than Perreault coming on to mix it up, which perhaps suggests that there's, if not been a change of hierarchy, there's maybe been a change in Farke's head when it comes to who he thinks is most likely to make an impact off the bench. And I would go along with that at the moment, that I would expect more from Joseph off the bench currently than I would from Perreault. So it's all a little bit weird. I think you can move on from it quite quickly when it works and it doesn't cause a problem. But without having been in the ground on Monday, I can imagine it was a pretty anxious moment for the crowd as all that was going on.
It was very much so, especially because Junior Firpo had the ball in his hands to start with.
I think
it was just winding up Michael.
Firpo's the decoy. We've had this.
The thing is, not a very good decoy, though, is he? Because there's no way that Hull's defence were looking at him going, yeah, he's going to take this. Yeah.
Well, he might surprise them one day when he steps up to knock in the penalty to send us up. But yeah, I think with Somerville, he's undoubtedly got a cockiness about him, hasn't he, in the way he plays the game. And if anyone is going to wrestle the ball off someone to take it, I don't mind it being him, because I feel like he can back it up and he would have the confidence to do it. You almost don't want, what you don't want is someone doing that to make a point. I'm thinking maybe Pat Bamford. When he's insisted on taking penalties, but you've gone, oh no, I don't think this is a good idea. Whereas Somerville, I did kind of anticipate he would score.
I know you're whispering Bamford there, but that's how it felt at Stoke. It felt a little bit like, I'm taking this and I'm going to make a point to people and I'm ideally going to score this, which he didn't. But in Bamford's body language at the time, you weren't seeing a huge amount of confidence. So whereas with Somerville, he was picking up the ball and he thought, he probably will score this. I think with Bamford, we were all sat, particularly after what had gone on before. And it's different with Bamford now. You know, things have changed for him since January. He's scored a lot of goals. He's played well. He's made a big difference to the season. But at that point at Stoke, back in October, it was quite the opposite. And there just was that tension around the fact that it was him who was going to hit it. So, yeah, I agree. I think with Somerville, he does have this kind of self-confidence, which always runs the risk, I think, of players like that of crossing the line and causing yourself a problem. But I don't think Farke would in any way want regular repeat of four or five players having to get involved to decide who's taking this. It should be a little bit clearer than that But I do understand that if Pirou's only been on the pitch for a few minutes, then perhaps it does become a bit of a grey area.
Yes, and I do think that Pirou's impact in both of the goals has gone underrated slightly. The fact that he took that decision by Somerville and by Ampadu and Farko by proxy and went, okay, and retreated quite quickly is a big move. And then the ball that he played into Dan James was perfectly weighted and the finish was absolutely fantastic. And
it
erupts.
It was brilliant. Like somebody was saying, the chance of you let your country down followed by 45-yard banger from the right touchline was pretty beautiful. I mean, to give Pirou his due, he's scored a lot of goals this season. Not as many as I think people would have thought he'd have come up with, given that he was being signed as the goal scorer last summer. And I still don't kind of feel that there's been a more influential goal when it comes to chasing the top two than that penalty at the end against Preston. I still think that had that finished 1-1, there'd have been a lot of people coming out of Elland Road saying, oh, it's going to be the playoffs now. And that just kept it on course at the right time. So I think, even though you'd probably have hoped for a little bit more from Pirou for the money that was spent on him, I still think it'll go down as a good signing when it comes to the way the squad's been put together in its entirety.
Definitely.
And you're right. It wasn't as if he just said yes to Somerville immediately, but he didn't sort of fight his corner in a way that caused a problem. Once it was decided, he did just back off, and that's kind of what needs to happen.
Yeah. If he were to stay there for an extra 10, 15 seconds, then the pressure gets even further. So he did. I think he did really well.
I just think if Somerville had missed that, they'd have been absolutely healthy.
Oh, God. Of course. So after the game, we learned that we were basically the walking dead. Somerville had some issue. I don't know if he'd specified. Rodon was having back spasms, played with painkillers. Byram shuffled over to his manager at halftime and said, I can't sprint. And he says, okay, well, you do your thing. And
I can't sprint. No, I saw Byram saying he was running at 80%. I only ever run at 80% tops, yeah.
And Kamara was playing with an illness. And so I think that puts context onto the performance and also the result. Really good result against Hull.
Yeah, I came away from Watford thinking, to be fair to Farke, he said a lot after the game about, at the international break, that this and that, and it disrupted us. We couldn't train, everything else. But we asked him after the Millwall game, is it good to have a break, finally have a couple of weeks where you can, take it easy and get away from the games for a while? And he basically said no. He's not really, because people will be going away, won't be able to do much work. We're winning games, flowing nicely. So I don't think he actually wanted the international break and then pretended with hindsight that he didn't. I don't think it suited him to do that. And they're clearly not in the best of fettle physically, but then they're never going to be at this time of year. And I think this is the point. I said this about Gruev, but they haven't done it to this point. But I think this is the stage of the season where you do start to lean on people a little bit and say, look, even if you're not, like you said to Byram, if you can't sprint, don't sprint, or at least, keep yourself within a limit where you feel like your hamstring isn't going to go, or whatever it is that, is causing you grief. Whereas earlier in the season, you very much try not to take risks with anybody. And I've said before, I don't think coaches like to look as if they're so reliant on one player that they'll play him if they've got a leg hanging off. I think they like it to look as if they can manage any situation. There does come a moment in the season where you need your big players, you need your key players, and sometimes you have to ask a little bit more of them, and that was clearly going on Monday night.
I feel like poor Sam Byram must have felt like Warnock was back in charge, flogging just, him to death.
Just
on
play
that
anyway.
Side.
Yeah, keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think, it's that time of the season, and especially when there's that many players. So, Somerville, Roden, Byram, Kamara, Gruev can't get in the team. I think there has to be a decision made, which is, side before self, play through the pain barrier.
Yeah, definitely. And just to go back to Cooper as well, I'm actually one of these people who thinks that they've had great value for money out of Cooper, for £600,000 to Chesterfield, 10 seasons. I think at points he's played really well. I think he was a big influence in the promotion season. And I also think it's probably slightly underestimated how good a captain he's been away from the pitch as well. It's an easy club leads to lose control of the dressing room, and it's easy for politics to overtake everything. And that hasn't really been the case too much, certainly in the Bielsa era when things were going well. He seemed like him and the other people around him, like Dallas and Ayling and Forshaw, seemed like a good core for everybody else to orbit around. But I do think, as I say, definitely coming to the end with Leeds. And I think you naturally get more confidence in the crowd when you have Ampadu and Rodon there, who have been, the stat being that that partnership hadn't conceded in open play in the league. And then it's broken up and you concede twice in open play at Watford before half time. I have to say, I actually impressed by Watford individually. I thought there's some very good players individually and seemed far more creative and lively and bright than they were when they came to Elland Road. I can't remember anything of their performance at Elland Road, but there was a lot in that at Vicarage Road that was decent, and they are just ever more this weird club who seem like they could do good things, but forever pull the carpet from under themselves. But yeah, you have Ampadoon Road on there. I think the crowd automatically feel more confident in that, and that's probably projected onto the players. I think you'd have to say that the players feel more confident about that combination as well. It's been there for such a long time now. You do want to see your big faces on the pitch, and this is when that matters most.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I want to just touch on someone who isn't a problem of ours anymore necessarily, but is going through a bit of a tough time. Calvin Phillips. I saw a tweet of yours, Phil, in the week saying after the gesture he made to a West Ham fan about him being just one of the nicest guys in that he'd met in football. What's going on with him there? Does he just need to get out? Does he need to come home, Michael? What do we think, Phil?
Well, I'll do a straw poll here because Twitter seemed to be divided between those who were kind of interested in that tweet and did feel very sorry for him and those who aren't interested in the slightest and feel like we should all move on. So you tell me.
Interested in what, bringing him back or in his
Just in him, yeah, generally, yeah.
I feel sorry for him.
Yeah.
Is the gist of it. Well, it was weird because earlier in the season, there was some talk about, oh, he might end up coming back to Leeds. And I thought, well, we can't afford him for one. Even if we go up, we probably can't afford him. But that's, having had a now, what is, can we call it a failed loan spell at West Ham? It's not gone well. He needs to do a lot to turn it around, doesn't he?
Oh, it's been dreadful. Yeah.
But it's impossible to imagine anyone is going to pick up all of his wages from his Man City contract. So either there needs to be some sort of payoff or it'll be a loan with the club picking up half the money or whatever. I was thinking earlier in the season, I probably wouldn't do him any good to come back. I don't know where he'd fit in. I don't think it'd be necessarily a good move for us. But then a bit of me goes, oh, for his own good, bring him back.
Yeah. Spend the money for, yeah.
Well, that was kind of the reason why I wanted to touch on it really briefly is because of the human side of it, you know? You've met him a few times, interviewed him, and I've, you know, got close to him, and he just seems lost, like a little lost lamb. And because he's one of our own, you know, he's a Wortley boy, I thought it might be worth just kind of asking tentatively whether or not you might see a future for him at Elland Road.
I always liked Calvin, and I always liked the fact that his story was quite different to most academy players, how late he'd come in. And I think what struck me most with him was the development he'd undergone with Bielsa and how he went from this player, and I always say this, player whose exact role as a midfielder you couldn't quite put your finger on, you couldn't work out whether the attempts to play him further forward had been good, whether he was just one of those midfielders who sat in the middle of the pitch, it never, to my mind, really been used as a defensive pivot in the way that Bielsa did with him. But he was so good in that team and really, you know, genuinely so good that it was hard not to admire his performances. And I never felt either that with the move to City, it was a case of taking the money. I think it was the fact, and because it was Phillips who asked to go. By the same token, I think Leeds needed the money at the time. You know, I think they're happy to have that run of income. But it was Rafinha who they'd settled on more as somebody who was definitely leaving because he'd made it really clear that they wanted to go to Barcelona. But, you know, I think for Phillips, he was looking at joining the best club in Europe, and he knew he was going to win things there. he knew if he played well and was with Guardiola, he would probably get better again. And it just hasn't worked. And for everything that's gone on between him and Guardiola, I didn't see a way back anyway before he went to West Ham. I think even less so now that it's gone like this. I actually thought West Ham could be quite a good move for him. I thought there were aspects of their tactics and the way they play that might suit his longer range passing, particularly with quick runners up front. But it's been a disaster, isn't it, that move? It's just not worked. And he's got himself into that awful position, and nobody does this deliberately, where everything that goes wrong seems to be revolving around him, or an awful lot of it is. And I think that with the you know, him getting on the bus, middle finger to whoever it was that was giving him some, from in front of the bus, support, West Ham support there, I think it tells you that he's at a really low ebb, you know, and needs something to change. There's going to have to be some way of negotiating him out of City in the summer, whether that's again on loan or via permanent, and everybody's going to have to be sensible about the numbers involved. Whether he comes back to Leeds, I think if Leeds don't go up, absolutely not. If they do go up, it will depend 100% on how Farke sees his team, what he thinks he needs, because he has dictated everything in terms of transfers since he's come to Leeds, and in his period as head coach. It's not that you, as manager, you don't have, it's not that you don't have other people there. You've got Nick Hammond, obviously, you've got Greta Steinsen as well. So you have a big kind of transfer committee, if you want to call it that, but his is the final say, you know, and that would be the same in the summer. So in terms of, I don't know what on earth his thinking would be on Phillips. So the only thing I could say is, in terms of whether that's an option, it would be down to him.
It's going to reoccur as a story forever, though.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Until he's back at Leeds.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that, but it's most certainly going to reoccur as a story in the summer, isn't it?
It was like Alan Smith back to Leeds was talked about just forever.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Milner as well, James Milner, you know. So you're right. In 5 years' time, this could still be going around. But 100% through the summer, there will be stories about, if Leeds go up, about Calvin Phillips.
You're looking forward to the transfer speculation, summer fellow.
But we've just kicked it off now. Any news? Tremendous.
Yeah, I'll get some pelters for bringing this topic up because he's not a Leeds player. But I just thought from the human element, from that human point, I just wanted to kind of touch on it.
And I've never really been. I've never really been that sort that's kind of thought, as soon as somebody's gone, just forget about them completely. You know, there's still a bit of narrative there, and it's quite interesting.
Of course. But thinking ahead to the summer and whether or not that transfer might materialise, all depends on where we finish in the league. And so the next game is Coventry away, Saturday, 3 p.m, the rarest of beasts, a 3 p.m. kickoff on the Saturday.
I think, is this guy just giving it one weekend of going, look, it's not all the time, must be.
Do you think maybe it's a gesture?
Yeah, possibly. And weirdly, this is a pretty good game.
Very good game.
It's one I'd have picked.
Let's preview it. So they're seventh, they're four behind Norwich, but they've got a game in hand. They just lost to Cardiff. Is it a good time to play them?
I like Coventry. I think they're a really good team. Played incredibly well against Wolves in the FA Cup, but I thought they were good at Elland Road as well. Without being sparkling or outstanding, he seems pretty savvy tactically, Robbins. Built a good team. And I felt like they were just about worth the point that they took away. I thought they played well enough on the day. James could have won it right at the end, right in injury time. But I thought they were good. So they're one of several clubs who are just kind of hanging in at the moment, aren't they, and hoping it's going to go their way. But I do think, looking through the fixtures, and without knowing what is going to be on Southampton on the final day, because that could obviously be really difficult, that game, but I do think this is as challenging as any. We said on the previous pod that this run of games, Watford, Hull, Coventry, you know, pretty tough. And I think, you know, with hindsight, I think Farke would be pretty chuffed to have got through the Easter weekend with 4 points. I think that's a good return, given that it keeps Leeds in the top two.
Most definitely, and especially with the context around the missing players and the walking wounded, like we said. And 7 points out of those nine would represent a really good foundation to build on towards the end of the season. What do you think, Michael? Is this the hardest game that we'll face towards the end of this championship?
This and Middlesbrough away both look a bit sticky, I would say. I mean, the home games that are left, you're looking at Blackburn, Sunderland, which on paper should be easy games because they've got nothing to play for. So I know there's a bit of rivalry with Sunderland, but the wind has well and truly gone from them this season. They just want it over with, is the impression I get there. And then into Southampton on the final day, which should pretty much be dead for them by then.
Oh, I thought you were going to say dead rubber.
No, for them.
For them,
but,
yeah.
But they should be just rest all your players for the playoffs. Let's not have any injuries. If that's all right. So yeah, I'm a bit worried about this one, I have to say. It depends on other games, because it could be that, you know, Ipswich lose, we get a point, and you go, actually, decent, that's not a bad weekend, really, all in all. But it's so dependent on other people at this stage.
I was thinking that driving in is a draw a good result from this game. And I think go back 2 or 3 months and you'd have said, yeah, it definitely is. Now it depends entirely on what happens elsewhere. And it might well be that it is a good result. I think if you got a draw out of this and you stayed top two, you'd be quite happy with that. And you might remember Farke saying a few weeks back how if Leeds won every home game, which they look very capable of doing, and drew every away game before the end of the season, they'd end up on something like 96 points, and that might conceivably be enough. So I don't think deep down he would think that a draw at Coventry would be a bad result, but that is going to be totally dictated by, you know, what Ipswich do, what Leicester do.
I did, for some reason, torch myself this week and go through one of those, you know, like where you put in the scores.
Oh, no!
I've been trying to avoid doing it, and then I was looking at fixtures for the main pod, and I was like, I'm just gonna put them all in. And I did have a second.
Right.
With Ipswich a point behind. I had us on 99 and 98 points.
Who top? Leicester.
Leicester top. Yeah. Okay.
Is the way I had it going. I think it might have been 100, 99, 98 were the top three.
You see, I can't...
But I could do it another 100 times. It'd be different.
I don't know about you, but I'm not sure I can see Southampton getting back into this now. It feels like the gap's a little bit too big and that their form is going to have to be so good before the end of the season. And given some of the games that have fallen in it, you know, Leicester and Leeds as well, seems to be asking an awful lot. Which makes me wonder what's going to be on the game when they play Leicester, the rearranged game, as well as the game at Leeds. And Leicester are still a threat, without a doubt. I think they were probably, on Easter Monday, on the verge of, you know, really, really feeling the pinch. And actually, I wondered if the defeat on Good Friday might do that to them as well. But it was an important turnaround for them, and they're still very much in the hunt.
Absolutely. So as for the Coventry game, as far as one to watch, we're speaking before Farke's presser. Is that got to be Gruev?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm also really interested by Joseph at the moment, though. He just seems like another player, and this has happened all season, players who have not played that much and then have come into the team, made a big difference. I don't think he'll start. I think if Bamford's fit and able to play, that's how it'll go. But it can't be insignificant, I don't think, that when Farke on Monday felt the need to change it and felt the need to really go after a goal, that it was Joseph he was reaching for, rather than Pirro. So that will be interesting. But if Gruev is back, does Farke revert to that? I think he probably does.
Yeah, and does he revert back to the back four that had carried us so well with Gray back at right back again? Probably.
Again, so. I would think so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Especially if Pearl Byram is still not able to sprint running at 80%. Yeah.
He can't have played that much football in such a condensed period of time for a lot of years, can he?
It's asked a lot of him, and I suppose with hindsight you would say that this was probably always going to happen. There was going to come a stage of the season where it was difficult for his body to hold up. But they've still easily got the money's worth out of Byram as a free transfer. It's been a really good sign in that.
Most definitely. Okay, thank you, Phil. We'll have Dan back on Saturday for the match ball after the Coventry City game. And Dan will be here to catch up with Phil next week. This is my last show here. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for watching and listening along this week. And we will speak to you later.
The Square Ball Podcast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.